Hello and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks, The Learning College. Today we're going to do part two, chapters 4 to 7, roughly 20 pages, of Libido Dominandi, Sexual Liberation and Political Control by E. Michael Jones, published back in 2000 by St. Augustine's Press out of South Bend, Indiana. And this is going to cover Greenwich Village, Zurich, New York, and Baltimore in the 1913 to 1916 range. Let's start by looking at the endnotes. Before we do that, everything we record can be found at vnnforum.com first, and then eventually can be found at alexlinder.com as a permanent archive of homeschooling audio material you can listen to. This would be suitable for teenagers. Now, we're in part two. We're going to do part two, chapters 4 to 7. Let's look at the end notes and see how meaty they are. They're not super, super thick through all these chapters, which are briefer. They're more 5 or 6 pages. Chapter 4, E. Fuller Torrey. We heard about this last time. Freudian Fraud, The Malignant Effect of Fraud's Theory on American Thought and Culture. That's from 1992. Larry Tye, T.Y.E., The Father of Spin, Edward L. Bernays and the Birth of Public Relations. Freud's relative styles himself the father of public relations, Edward Bernays, B-E-R-N-A-Y-S. Also from book Edward Bernays' Propaganda from 1928. Part 2, Chapter 5, Zurich, 1914. We've got Lavinia Edmonds, His Master's Choice from Johns Hopkins Magazine in April of 1998. Not too much else in there. And then Part 6, New York, 1914, Part 2, Chapter 6, Ellen Chesler, Women of Valor, Woman of Valor, Margaret Sanger and the Birth Control Movement in America, from Simon & Schuster in 1992, one of the big houses, the Big Six, they used to be called. I think they're down to 5 or maybe even 4 now. Then in Chapter 7 of Part 2, and again, the three-part book, we've already done the first part, which is short, and then Part 2 and Part 3 are longer. Part 2, Chapter 7, Baltimore, 1916, Watson, Behaviorism, Walter Lippmann, Public Opinion, from 1922. And that's pretty much it. Now let's turn to the text itself. Part 2, Chapter 4, Greenwich Village, 1913. The year 1913 was an annus mirabilis, miraculous year, of sorts. The year before the Great War was the year during which modernity surfaced, and it can only be compared with 1921, the year when The Wasteland and Ulysses appeared, the year when the forces of dissolution freed by the war's dislocation of mores and morals began to be implemented on a wide scale. It was during 1913 that John B. Watson gave his lectures on behaviorism at Columbia University in competition with Henry Bergson, who was speaking downtown, but the paradigmatic event of that year was the Armory Show, which introduced New York and America to the trends which would dominate the art world after the war. The most famous picture at the Armory Show was Marcel Duchamp's Nude Descending a Staircase, an importation of the Cubist techniques which Braque and Picasso had developed, but which one American perceived as an explosion in a shingle factory. Again, E. Michael Jones has a background in art. Plato said that changes in musical form presaged changes in the state. The same could be said of painting. Cubism was, of course, a revolt against morals, but the new forms were so bewildering that few people understood it as such. The few people who did lived in Greenwich Village and felt that the rest of New York, the city above 14th Street, was, quote, cut off from the village like the ego from the id. The comparison gives some indication of how Freud's theories took America's bohemia by storm during the first decade of the 20th century, as perhaps the opening shot in the publicity campaign that would make Freudian terminology part of the cultural lingua franca by the 1920s. Max Eastman wrote 2 long articles on Freud in 1915 in Everybody's Magazine. in italics, which at the time had a circulation of 600,000 readers. Eastman, who would go on to become a communist and then an anti-communist, end up writing for the Washington Times before he died, described psychoanalysis as a new treatment, which I believe may be of value to hundreds of thousands of people, a method for dissecting out mental cancers which will leave you sound and free and energetic. The one thing Eastman never abandoned was his sexual libertinism, and before long it became clear that this was the force driving the acceptance of Freud's theory of psychoanalysis among the bohemians in Greenwich Village. In 1916, fellow radical Floyd Dell, also associated with Eastman on the editorial board at The Masses, went into psychoanalysis. He would later say that, quote, "Everyone at that time who knew about psychoanalysis was a sort of missionary on the subject, and nobody could be around Greenwich Village without hearing a lot about it." Dell's psychoanalyst was Samuel A. Tannenbaum, an early proponent of sexual liberation, who felt that sexual abstinence was psychologically dangerous. Tannenbaum also advocated the legalization of prostitution, feeling that if young men frequented prostitutes, they would dissipate dangerous amounts of frustrated excitement. Another early convert to the Gospel of Freud was a young journalist by the name of Walter Lippmann, Jew, a man who would later be called the prophet of the New Liberalism. Reading Freud was for Lippmann an almost religious experience, something significant for someone who did not believe in religion, organized or otherwise. Lippmann, the young Harvard graduate, when searching for the epiphany which might be commensurate to his discovery of Freud, could only compare it to the feeling his father's generation might have had on discovering Darwin. In 1914, Lippmann was named associate editor of the New Republic, the flagship of the New Liberalism, and with this new journal as his platform, Lippmann and his friend Alfred Booth Kuttner, one of the first people to be psychoanalyzed by Freud's American student A.A. Brill, began to pump out flattering accounts of Freud's new theory. Freudianism, through Lippmann, would become a constitutive part of American liberalism, as well as one of the intellectual constructs Lippmann would use to analyze social problems. He became a very famous public columnist, probably the number one in the first half of the 20th century, apart from maybe Mencken. Lippmann also brought the Freudian gospel to Mabel Dodge's salon, where it quickly spread further among the intellectuals there. Dodge was so taken with the new theories as a possible explanation of her own bisexual behavior that she immediately began analysis with Brill. Brill, a man with his own set of sexual compulsions and a penchant for smutty jokes, was if anything more forthright than Freud when it came to advocacy of sexual liberation. Quote, "With a normal sexual life," he is quoted as saying in Lippmann's article, "there is no such thing as a neurotic." This excuse for sexual indulgence was just what the boho crowd in the village wanted to hear. And during the second decade of the 20th century, Freud's ideas were adopted by them as their own. According to one observer, Freudian theory, which implicitly encouraged sexual freedom, became a wedge used, quote, "to liberate American literature from pruderies and other social restrictions." It may well be that the freedom to write about sex, which was linked with other freedoms, would have been won without the intervention of Freud, but the literary exploitation of Freud was a heavy reinforcement at a decisive moment and materially assisted the coming of age of our literature. Because back then you could be sued for having sexual stuff in books and then or more for selling those books. Mencken was involved with a case like that. The blue stockings were a real thing. Right around the time of the Armory Show, a 21-year-old by the name of Eddie Bernays had, at the urging of a friend, taken over the editorship of an obscure journal known as Medical Review of Reviews. Eddie had always had a perceptive ear for what people were saying, and perhaps because the Freudian id was successfully seeping uptown from the village, sex was on people's minds, and Eddie saw an opportunity to make money out of it. Eddie understood the words of one New York editor who announced on March 15, 1913, that it was 6 o'clock in America. In the early months of 1913, Bernays received a review of a play called Damaged Goods, written by the French playwright Eugene Brieux, B-R-I-E-U-X. Damaged Goods told the story of a man who contracts syphilis, then marries, then fathers a syphilitic child. The review was a frontal attack on the sensibilities of the times and perceived as such by the magazine's conservative audience. Far from being cowed by the reaction, Bernays approached an actor who had indicated a desire to produce the play, pledging the magazine's support. "The editors of the Medical Review of Reviews," Bernays wrote to Richard Bennett, "support your praiseworthy intention to fight sex pruriency in the United States by producing your play, Damaged Goods. You can count on our help." And this is before they had a cure for syphilis. Bernays was so gratified by Bennett's favorable response that he immediately agreed to underwrite the cost of the production, an ambitious undertaking for someone who was making $25 a week. Bernays understood intuitively that there was a market for sexual liberation and that he could tap that market financially by turning the play into a cause célèbre. Damaged Goods could stand for freedom of expression on sexual matters, and in order to make his point, he began to enlist the support of a group of influential New Yorkers who shared his point of view. One of the first people to come on board the Medical Review of Reviews, Sociological Fund Committee to help in the fight against prudery, was John D. Rockefeller, who explained to the young Bernays that, quote, "the evils springing from prostitution cannot be understood until frank discussion of them has been made possible." Hundreds of checks poured in from people like the Rockefellers and Mr. and Mrs. Franklin D. Roosevelt, and Eddie was on his way to becoming, as he would call himself later in what would prove to be a very long life, he died at the age of 103, the father of public relations, end quotes. Eddie Bernays had parlayed his interest in sex into the creation of the first front group and a career that would ride the crest of the advertising and public relations wave that would break over the United States, transforming the country into what it is today. Something with national markets, national advertising campaigns, group molding, using the new technology and the new sciences or pseudosciences of behavioral control, image manipulation, mental manipulation. The front group as a technique for manipulating public opinion would dominate cultural life during the 20th century, and the subterfuge whereby economic interest would camouflage its manipulation would become increasingly sophisticated to the point where, quote, "today it takes a detective to unmask the interest behind such innocuous sounding groups as the Safe Energy Communication Council, anti-nuclear, the Eagle Alliance, pro-nuclear, and the Coalition Against Regressive Taxation, trucking industry." It all started with sex, Eddie would say, describing his remarkable career. If so, the beginning was not auspicious financially. As soon as Bennett acquired the rights to the play, he told Bernays to get lost. "I don't need your damn sociological fund anymore," he wrote to Bernays. Not one to brood, Bernays decided that the money he hadn't earned was ancillary to the lessons about manipulating public opinion, which he had learned. And so in the summer of 1913, he decided to escort a young man to Europe to talk over the psychological implications of what he had learned with his uncle. His decision was not based simply on familial ties. Eddie Bernays' uncle was Sigmund Freud. The details of their conversation as the 21-year-old Bernays tramped through the woods surrounding Carlsbad in what was soon to become Czechoslovakia with his by-then-famous 57-year-old uncle have been lost to posterity. The general tenor of their conversation, however, was clear. Bernays had made his first foray into manipulating public mind by appealing to its sexual interest, and since his uncle was famous as an authority on sex, Eddie wanted to know what he knew so he could apply it to mass man. "Whatever the specifics of their conversation," writes Ty, "it is clear that when Eddie returned to New York in the fall of 1913, he was more taken than ever with the Viennese doctor's novel theories on how unconscious drives dating to childhood make people act the way they do. And Eddie was convinced that understanding the instincts and symbols that motivate an individual could help him shape the behavior of the masses." In trying to understand the intellectual connection between Eddie and his famous uncle, Ty is hampered, unfortunately, by certain misconceptions about Sigmund Freud and psychoanalysis. Bernays's ideas, Ty tells us, reflected the profound influence of his uncle Sigmund. He talked about the use of symbols, as Freud did, and of the centrality of stereotypes, individual and community, that will bring favorable responses. He was as driven by as his uncle to know what subconscious forces motivated people, and he used Freud's writings to help him understand. But while the esteemed analyst tried to use psychology to free his patients from emotional crutches, Bernays used it to rob consumers of their free will, helping his clients predict then manipulate the very way their customers thought and acted, all of which he openly acknowledged in his writings. At another point, Tai repeats the same misconception of Freud. Quote, Bernays is a philosopher, not a mere businessman. He is a nephew of that other great philosopher, Dr. Sigmund Freud. Unlike his distinguished uncle, he is not known as a practicing psychoanalyst, but he is a psychoanalyst just the same, for he deals with the science of unconscious mental processes. His business is to treat unconscious mental acts by conscious ones. The great Viennese doctor is interested in releasing the pent-up libido of the individual. His American nephew is engaged in releasing and directing the suppressed desires of the crowd. And again, in the same vein, Tai claims that, quote, while Freud sought to liberate people from their subconscious drives and desires, Eddie sought to exploit those passions. Turning on to 135. As with James Jones in his analysis of the relationship between Kinsey and the Rockefeller interest, Tai proposes a dichotomy where none exists. Eddie Bernays did not have a different goal in mind when he proposed exploiting the sexual passion for financial gain. It's exactly what Sigmund was doing. Bernays' uncle Sigmund, as the case of Horace Frank makes clear, had been doing this for some time. In fact, even Freud himself admitted that psychoanalysis wasn't really medicine. In his more candid moments with his friend and confidant Wilhelm Fleiss, Freud referred to patients as goldfish and Negroes, making it quite clear that psychoanalysis was a form of psychic control for financial benefit of the analyst. The transaction was quite simple, and transacted many times in places like Greenwich Village. In exchange for permission to gratify his sexual passions, the patient would receive absolution from the psychoanalyst, acting as a crypto-confessor for a financial consideration. Bernays and his famous uncle were both involved in exploiting sexual passion for financial gain. The only difference was the medium the younger man chose. Freud bilked his patients individually in psychoanalytic sessions. Bernays tried to manipulate the country collectively through the mass media, by means of advertising and public relations. In both instances, the technique was pure Illuminism, something which Bernays makes clear in his writings, specifically his 1928 magnum opus, Propaganda, where he tells us that, quote, we are dominated by the relatively small number of persons, a trifling fraction of our 120 million, who understand the mental processes and social patterns of the masses. America was now ruled by a group of, quote, invisible governors, composed of PR professionals like Bernays, who pull the wires which control the public mind, who harness old forces and contrive new ways to bind and guide the world. These invisible governors were necessary to the orderly functioning of group life. In fact, the invisible governors helped to bring order out of chaos. Democratic man, in other words, needed control as soon as he was liberated. Part 2, Chapter 5, Zurich, 1914. 5 years after Jung treated Metal McCormick, Metal's sister-in-law, Edith Rockefeller McCormick, showed up in Zurich to be treated for a depression stemming from the death of her daughter, Editha. Over the course of the next 10 years, Jung corrupted Edith. Maybe that's a typo. Maybe it was just Edith. So over 10 years, Jung corrupted Edith with a steady diet of astrology and spiritualism, turning her into an agoraphobic woman who never left her hotel room. All this was done in the name of the first therapy and then training. After Jung convinced Edith to become a therapist in the Jungian mold. Eventually, her withdrawal from the world brought about her divorce from her husband and dying in poverty in a hotel in Chicago, but not before Jung exploited his doctor-patient relationship with her by persuading her to give Jung's organization the equivalent of $2 million. With the break with Jung and the formation of a secret society, Freud not only brought about a permanent schism at the heart of the psychoanalytic movement, he also, in terms of financial influence, seemed to come out on the losing side of the break, for psychiatry was now split between Aryan and Jewish practitioners, and all of the wealthy patients, especially those coming from America, were quote-unquote Aryans, specifically wealthy Protestants whose grasp on Christian principle was becoming looser by the year. By granting Metal McCormick permission to gratify his desires, Jung gained a foothold with one of the wealthiest families in America. By treating Edith, He was now parlaying that foothold into contact with the wealthiest family in America. When Edith Rockefeller McCormick showed up at Jung's door, her father's personal fortune comprised about 2% of the gross national product of the United States of America. In 1916, Freud, hardly able to control his envy, wrote to Ferenczi complaining that Jung had latched onto a rich American who had given him a building in Zurich. Freud had often said that Americans were good for one thing, money, and now the pupil was proving himself superior to his master in exploiting rich Americans for financial gain. Freud was no stranger to the idea of exploiting his patients for financial gain. Freud, according to Peter Swales, quote, had in psychotherapy some of the richest women in the world. On August 1, 1890, he wrote to Wilhelm Fliess, declining an invitation to visit him in Berlin, and certainly he was alluding to Anna von Leiben, whom he would dub his prima donna, when he explained, quote, my chief woman client is now undergoing a kind of nervous crisis, and during my absence she might get well. Freud feared his patient might get well during his absence, a curious attitude for a doctor to have. However, the attitude is not curious if psychoanalysis is nothing more than crypto-illuminous psychic control. To say that Freud was involved in medicine belies his real intention. Patients, Freud told Ferenczi toward the end of his life, are, quote, trash, unquote. Quote, only good for making money out of, and for studying, certainly we cannot help them. Psychoanalysis as therapy, he concluded, may be worthless. Swales goes on to say that several members of the von Leiben family regarded Freud as a charlatan who kept Anna in a state of permanent hypernervosity by means of the interminable daily seances that Freud called therapy. Freud's biggest fear was that his patient might get well, and that's a quote. The disease was iatrogenic. The purpose of therapy was not cure, but control. Control, in this instance, for financial gain. So psychoanalysis is basically a scam for Freud to get rich, masquerading as medicine, masquerading as science, sold to the world that way by PR, nepotistic PR people. 5 years after Freud expressed his envy of Jung and the money he was receiving from the Rockefeller family, Freud had his own chance to fleece a wealthy American, although not someone as wealthy as John D. Rockefeller's daughter. By 1921, the Austro-Hungarian Empire was history, and Austrian money barely worth the paper it was printed on. Since Freud charged his patients in dollars, he was always happy when a wealthy American showed up at his door. Horace Frank showed up in 1921. He was not wealthy. He was an aspiring psychoanalyst who had come to Vienna for the analysis with a master which was necessary for certification, but like most analysts of the time, he treated wealthy patients. Frank was a physician and aspired to be a psychoanalyst in the Freudian school, and in order to do that, he had to lie down on the couch and bare his soul to the master. During the course of the analysis, Frank described his erotic attraction to one of his wealthy patients, a woman by the name of Angelica Bijur. Sensing a financial killing, Freud capitalized on the situation by telling Frank to dump his wife and marry Bijur. Frank initially resisted, but after 6 months, finally came around to Freud's point of view, eventually divorcing his wife. But the analysis wasn't over yet. Freud then persuaded Frank that he had a homosexual attachment to Freud, which expressed itself in Frank's desire to make Freud, quote, a rich man. Quote, your complaint that you cannot grasp your homosexuality, Freud wrote to Frank, implies that you are not yet aware of your fantasy of making me a rich man. If matters turn out all right, let us change this imaginary gift into a real contribution to the psychoanalytic funds. Once again, Freud was exploiting the doctor-patient relationship for financial gain. In her account of the Frank affair, Edmund says that Freud openly encouraged this sexual liberation. In a letter to Bijur's ex-husband, Freud explains his analysis of Frank in the following terms. Quote, I simply had to read my patient's mind. And so I found that he loved Mrs. B., wanted her ardently, and lacked the courage to confess it to himself. I had to explain to Frank what his internal difficulties were, and did not deny that I thought it the good right of every human being to strive for sexual gratification and tender love if he saw a way to attain them, both of which he had not found with his wife. Freud first discovered the dominant passion of his client through therapy. Then he urged the patient to gratify that passion, absolving him of all guilt in his role as father confessor. Then, when the patient had succumbed to the temptation and was in most in need of absolution, Freud exploited the situation by trying to extort a financial contribution from the patient. The procedure was pure illuminism. It was most certainly not medicine. That becomes evident by the effect this therapy had on Frank, who succumbed almost immediately after his divorce and remarriage to a guilt-induced depression which he could not shake. The situation was made even worse when his wife died of pneumonia after being driven from their home and spending years on the road in one hotel after another with their two small children. Frank, in spite of Freud's absolution, never recovered from his wife's death. Less than 1 year after being re-elected to the presidency of the American branch of the Psychoanalytic Society, Frank ended up in a mental hospital himself, unable to shake the depression into which his guilt-ridden soul had fallen. Eventually, his second marriage fell apart under the strain, and Angelica Beeger began to suspect Freud's motives, feeling that he had arranged the marriage for his own financial benefit. Her suspicions were confirmed when she received a telegram from Freud after the marriage collapsed. "Extremely sorry," Freud wrote, "the point where you failed was money." Swales claims the problem of undue influence is virtually endemic to a profession which, after all, owes its very existence and propagation to a plethora of credulous individuals ready and able to pay out good money for the luxury of abdicating their mental sovereignty to another, all too often in a desperate bid to unburden themselves of moral responsibility for the wreckage of their lives. The, quote, abdication of mental sovereignty to another is the heart of the Illuminist project. However, the sovereignty lies not with the patient, but with the doctor. The thing which motivates the patient in a relationship like this is the gratification of illicit passion. This is Jones's thesis of pretty much all his works. People want to gratify their illicit passions, their be immoral sexually in particular, and they will pay money for people who will grant them the psychic license to do that, who justify them, rationalize it for them, provide them with reason so that it sounds like it's objective and external, so they can ignore their conscience. This is what Jones is arguing. The thing which motivates the patient, and he puts patient in quotes because it's not a real patient in a relationship like this. It's a mock, it's a pseudo-medicinal relationship, a pseudoscience carried out under the rubric of a pseudoscience. It's actually just a financial swindle. The thing which motivates the patient in a relationship like this is the gratification of illicit passion, the permission to transgress the moral law with impunity, with, in fact, the tacit approval of the therapist. The technique of control is pure illuminism, but the real motivation is to place the power to control in the hands of the illuminist therapist is sexual liberation. Psychotherapy wrote its position of power in America, in particular, on the back of sexual liberation because people wanted permission to transgress the moral law, and the Freudian therapists were willing to grant that permission for a price. Liberation, in this instance, became a form of bondage, as people who acted out their passions, often at the behest of their therapist, often with their therapists, quickly learned that they had to pay for the privilege of absolution, and the price they paid was an interminable and expensive regime of therapy. Sexual liberation, it turns out, was a form of financial control. Rumors, Torrey writes, quote, that psychoanalysts occasionally recommended sexual intercourse as a treatment for their patients proved to be true, and as early as 1910, Freud tried to quiet such accusations with an essay titled Wild Psychoanalysis. A physician told a woman who had left her husband, said Freud, that she could not tolerate the loss of intercourse with her husband, and so there were only three ways by which she could recover her health. She must either return to her husband, or take a lover, or obtain satisfaction from herself. In discussing the case, Freud acknowledged that psychoanalysis puts forward absence of sexual satisfaction as the cause of nervous disorders, but he said the physician in question had failed to point out a fourth possible solution, psychoanalysis. Freud did not say in this essay, however, that a recommendation to take a lover was necessarily wrong. Torrey documents Freud's seduction of America in detail, beginning with the years following his lectures at Clark University. Quote, between 1909 and 1917, Freud's ideas spread rapidly among New York's intelligentsia. According to one observer, Freudian theory, which implicitly encouraged sexual freedom, became a wedge used, quote, to liberate American literature from pruderies and other social restrictions. It may well be that the freedom to write about sex, which was linked with other freedoms, would have been won without the intervention of Freud, but the literary exploitation of Freud was a heavy reinforcement at a decisive moment and materially assisted the coming of age of our literature. The nomenklatura wanted to be seduced, that is, the leaders of the country, and the seduction, which succeeded beyond their wildest dreams, had, as its ultimate outcome, the destruction of one American institution after another, promising liberation to the gullible while granting covert control to the manipulators. Illuminism has proved the most durable of conspiracies. Part 2, Chapter 6, New York, 1914. Civilization's going to pieces, broke out Tom violently. I've got to be a terrible pessimist about things. Have you read The Rise of the Colored Empires by this man Goddard? Why, no, I answered, rather surprised by his tone. Well, it's a fine book, and everybody ought to read it. The idea is if we don't look out, the white race will be utterly submerged. It's all scientific stuff. It's been proved. Tom's getting profound, said Daisy, with an expression of unthoughtful sadness. He reads deep books with long words in them. It's from The Great Gatsby by F. Scott Fitzgerald. Again, we're in New York in 1914. The year 1914, it turns out, was a crucial turning point in the life of Margaret Sanger. Having married a Jewish architect by the name of William Sanger in 1902, at the age of 23, Margaret Higgins Sanger, so her real name is Higgins, she's married to a Jew named Sanger, Margaret Higgins Sanger moved in with him to Greenwich Village in 1910, where they were almost immediately swept up into the social and intellectual ferment that was brewing there at the time. Shortly after arriving there, the Sangers joined the Socialist Party, and 1 year later, Bill ran for office, an unsuccessful attempt to become a municipal alderman. More significant than any political education was the Sangers' introduction to the intellectual theories of the socialist cultural avant-garde. The Sangers became regular habitués at the salon of Mabel Dodge, where they met people like John Reed, Carlo Tresca, and Emma Goldman, who introduced Margaret, in Ellen Chesler's words, to a neo-Malthusian ideology then fashionable among European socialists, who disputed Marxist orthodoxies that condemned contraception as hopelessly bourgeois and encouraged a high proletarian birth rate. In Sanger, Goldman found an apt pupil, one who in fact appropriated her message and later refused to give her credit. But advocacy of birth control and free love was more than an intellectual exercise for Margaret Sanger. Before long, she began acting on the theories she espoused, to the chagrin of her husband, who unwittingly introduced her to the intellectual toxins that would destroy their marriage. In the Dodge Salon, Margaret became acquainted with Nietzsche, whose attack on religion and morality fit in congenially with the life she was espousing, if not practicing. Then, during the summer of 1913, theory, as it usually does, led to practice. While vacationing at John Reed's house in Provincetown, Margaret would occasionally travel to Boston to do research on birth control at that city's libraries. During that summer, Margaret had an affair, if not the first since she married, then the first one documented, with a magazine editor by the name of Walter Roberts. When her husband William found out about it, it seems to have changed his view of Greenwich Village. Within a period of 3 years, the avant-garde had changed in his eyes from being the cutting edge of a movement calling for social justice for the working classes into a, quote, Saturnalia of sexualism, deceit, fraud, and Jesuitism let loose. It's difficult to know, says Jones, which Jesuits he had in mind, but it is not difficult to see why his wife's hands-on experience with free love changed his view of the revolutionary workers' movement. What he previously saw as high ideals now seemed nothing more than a hellhole of free love, promiscuity, and prostitution masquerading under the mantle of revolution. Revolutionary politics, Sanger had to learn the hard way, was nothing more than a thinly disguised rationalization of sexual promiscuity. If revolution means promiscuity, he said, stating the same idea in a different context, they can call me a conservative and make the most of it. His disillusionment with socialism, though all but complete, came too late to save his marriage. Margaret was now committed to a life of sexual and drug-fueled self-indulgence, which would continue until her death. When her son Grant refused to increase the dosage of the Demerol his 70-year-old mother would crave, Margaret would say, with a lifetime of experience behind it, I am rich, I have brains, I can do anything I want. As the hedonism in her life increased, so did Margaret's attachment to the cause of birth control, so much so that it is virtually impossible not to see a correlation between the two. Birth control was the cause which absolved promiscuity of whatever baseness it retained in her mind. Without the cause of birth control, there was nothing but the base selfishness of her actions left confronting her, a prospect she found intolerable, especially when the reproach was brought by her children. Her third child, Peggy, had contracted polio during the summer of 1910, at around the same time the Sangers moved to Greenwich Village. The more Margaret got swept up in revolutionary politics and the affairs of the men who pursued those ideals, the more she neglected her children. During the summer of 1913, Margaret's affair with Walter Roberts coincided with a worsening of Peggy's situation. In spite of her husband's admonitions that something needed to be done about Peggy's leg, nothing got done, and Sanger then decided that a trip to Paris might allow him to pursue the career in painting he had chosen to the detriment of his family's financial security, and beyond that, draw Margaret out of the clutches of free love disguised as revolutionary politics. Neither hope was fulfilled. Margaret, in spite of the opportunity to research Parisian methods of contraception, was no scholar, and after tiring of Paris abruptly returned to New York, abandoning her husband and children. Peggy's condition seems to have weighed heavily on her mind at the time. She wrote letters to her daughter, assuring her of her love, and even started dreaming about her as well, dreams associated with the number 6. On the way back to New York, Sanger conceived a journal which she would call The Woman Rebel, a journal whose values included a woman's right to be lazy and her right to destroy. Gradually, the idea of a new ideology based on something more immediately appealing than struggle for the social justice of the working class began to take root in her mind. But in 1914, Mrs. Sanger was still a creature of the left, and so when in April of that year, detectives in the employ of the Rockefellers rampaged through a tent city populated by the families of striking miners in Colorado, killing women and children, she reacted in a fashion that bespoke her more uncritical allegiance to the left than anything. She called for the assassination of John D. Rockefeller. When later in life she would explain the indictments that forced her to leave the country in 1914, she would only mention sending birth control material through the mails, not the call to murder the scion of the Rockefeller family. The fact is not surprising because, by the time she was famous enough to be interviewed by the press, she was also the beneficiary of Rockefeller money as well. Within a period of 10 years, Sanger went from a position calling for Rockefeller's murder to having him as one of her major benefactors. Of all the benefactors she had during her lifetime, only one gave her more money than John D. Rockefeller, and that man was her second husband, Noah Slee, S-L-E-E, or Slee, who devoted his entire fortune to Sanger's cause. The philosopher's stone that worked this alchemy was contraception, and the alliance between the left and the wealthy which contraception forged has proved enduring indeed. They say that politics makes strange bedfellows, and if so, sexual politics makes bedfellows even stranger. But the alliance between John D. Rockefeller and the woman who once urged Americans to rise up and assassinate him is stranger than most. Yet, after a little thought, not so strange at all. In fact, the alliance is with us still because of the mutual needs it resolved. The Ludlow Massacre precipitated a chain of events that would have far-reaching consequences for both Margaret Sanger and John D. Rockefeller, Jr. Sanger would eventually flee the country to escape arrest for the article in which she urged her readers to remember Ludlow. In her exile in England, Margaret lacked nothing in terms of sexual or intellectual fulfillment, although sleeping with Havelock Ellis hardly seems to qualify on either count. A little jibe there from Jones. But she did miss her daughter, and in many respects felt guilty of abandoning her. As we turn on to 143, across to it. Dear Peggy, she wrote, how my heart goes out to you. I could weep for loneliness for you, just to touch your soft, chubby hands. But work is to be done, dear. Work to make your path easier, and those who come after you. As the letter makes obvious, the cause of birth control had become a panacea, if not for the world's problems, then at least for Margaret Sanger's guilty conscience. Sanger had abandoned her ailing daughter to follow a life of sexual self-indulgence, and the only thing that made this act tolerable to her guilty conscience was her crusade for birth control. Peggy, according to Sanger's guilty imagination, would eventually benefit from the liberation that her mother was carving out for all womankind. Unfortunately, Peggy never lived long enough to reap the benefits of her mother's crusade for birth control. Sanger's only daughter died unexpectedly of pneumonia on November 6, 1915. It was an event which would haunt Sanger for the rest of her life. Even Ellen Chesler, who applauds just about everything Sanger did, no matter how selfish, as necessary for liberation, perceived the devastating effects that the death of her daughter had on Sanger's psyche. Quote, Margaret never fully stopped mourning Peggy or exercised the guilt over having been absent during the final year of her brief life. For years later, she could not sit across from another mother and daughter on a train or in any other public setting without losing control. She wrote in her journal of recurrent sleeplessness, reporting that images of a child slipping away from her haunted her dreams and left her to awaken in tears. The death of Peggy had two principal effects. It got Sanger involved in the occult, and it turned the birth control crusade into something even more personally necessary to her psychic well-being, a personal obsession, in other words. Both effects were related to guilt. The main purpose of the seances was to talk to Peggy, something she found consoling primarily because the medium she consulted invariably told her what she wanted to hear. Chesler's reading of the connection between guilt over Peggy's death and the cause of birth control is fairly straightforward as well. Sanger could now satisfy a sense of maternal obligation without deviating from her chosen path, since Peggy remained with her, in effect, if not in reality, as the justification for her own professional preoccupations. The cause of birth control served the same purpose on a less personal level. Chesler again makes the same point, citing Sanger's claim that personal feelings were a necessary sacrifice to ideals that take possession of the mind. Even in Bill's letters from the winter of 1914, clearly she had invented a calling out of her work, which rationalized her disobedience as a wife and a mother. Or, as Chesler puts it at another point, through her work for birth control, Sanger would translate personal, painful circumstances into public achievements, and no one would stop her. In the absence of repentance, the most common way to assuage guilt feelings is by transmuting vice into a political cause. The birth control crusade seems to have fulfilled just this need in the lives of Margaret Sanger and the women she inspired. When the cause failed to do its work, Sanger would fall back on the occult and attend seances where Peggy would tell her that everything was okay, and if her conscience proved particularly imperious, there was always Demerol and alcohol, anodyne she used with increasing regularity late in life. I am rich, Margaret would repeat mantra-like. I have brains. I can do whatever I like. But sexual sin is not the only thing that weighs on the conscience. There are seven deadly sins, and although lust seems to dominate the 20th century as its vice of choice, avarice did well during the 19th. In fact, liberalism's attack on the moral order began by undermining the connection between the moral order and economics. Having accomplished that, the undermining of sexual morals was only a matter of time. Economics, it should be remembered, comes from the Greek for household, or family, an institution which has both a monetary and a sexual dimension. The oikos was what suffered under both regimes. The Ludlow Massacre, in this regard, provided a crucial nexus. Ensor and Johnson, Rockefeller's biographers, indicate that Junior was troubled by Ludlow, even to the point of traveling to Colorado, there to dance with the wives of his workers, just to defuse the disastrous publicity which resulted from the killing of over 700 people, many of them women and children. The symbolic gestures, however, did not deter Junior from his determination to bring the strikers to heel, which happened in December of 1914. The Ludlow Massacre also brought about the birth of public relations. William H. Baldwin, a pioneer in the field of public relations, didn't deny the role Eddie Bernays played in the rise of that field, but he located its beginning in another event. I date the emergence of public relations, he told Bernays' biographer, from the work that Ivy Lee did for John D. Rockefeller Sr. in the Colorado strike. Baldwin was referring to the Ludlow Massacre. The Ludlow Massacre is important because it is the starting point of a permutation that would have long-reaching political consequences. In the world of economics and population, there are only two alternatives, the Catholic and the eugenic. And these two alternatives would constitute the two opposing sides in the culture wars surrounding sexual liberation in the 20th century. Faced with want, faced with poverty on a widespread scale, faced with the girl holding the empty bowl in the Planned Parenthood overpopulation ads, We can either increase the amount of food or decrease the amount of people. The Catholics advocated the former alternative, the Malthusians the latter. In 1914, the picture was made a bit more complicated because the distribution side of the equation was represented more by the Revolutionary Workers' Movement, which in America was under the leadership of Bohemia, headquartered in Greenwich Village. As socialists, their agenda went well beyond the conditions of the workers, which was their ostensible raison d'être. The liberals in this situation, as represented by Margaret Sanger, were comprised by their commitment to sexual liberation, while at the same time the conservatives, as represented by John D. Rockefeller Jr., were compromised by their attachment to an unjust social order. Then as now, on a worldwide scale, inequitable distribution was the cause of scarcity. That's flat wrong. Flat wrong. But then as now, it was easier to grasp at a panacea than face up to the real problem. Contraception was that panacea, but it was also the device which allowed the convergence of the left and the propertied classes, which would become the basis of the New World Order, which emerged in the 1990s after the fall of communism. Contraception allowed the left to hold on to its desire for sexual liberation, just as it allowed the wealthy to hold on to the benefits accruing from an unjust social order by thwarting economic reform. Once there was widespread acceptance of the laicity of contraception, that it's morally justified, the poor could be blamed for their own lot in life, especially if they refused to go along with the eugenic measures of the powerful. The tying of World Bank loans to the acceptance of population policies based on contraception, abortion, and sterilization was the ultimate expression of this belief. See, the problem here, though, is that before all these corporations he's talking about existed, the population of like Africa was about 100 million, and now it's heading into the billions. So, there's unfair, just, they are the reason they exist, not any kind of Catholicism telling them to breed. The tying of World Bank loans to the acceptance of population policies based on contraception, abortion, and sterilization was the ultimate expression of this belief. Contraception was the invention which made the alliance of the wealthy in Bohemia not only possible, but a reality. The New World Order, as manifested in meetings like the United Nations-sponsored Conference on Population in Cairo in 1994, was Pocatico Hills and Greenwich Village united in imposing its neo-Malthusian ideology on the entire world. Once the U.S. government became involved in the promotion of contraception, an event which happened over the summer of 1965, a radical redefinition of the role of government was the inexorable result. When the influence of Monsignor John Ryan was determinative in Washington, government was there to aid in development. When that influence was replaced in the 60s by the spirit of Margaret Sanger, government's main role became the suppression of population. Even an observer as sympathetic to Sangerism as Ellen Chesler had to admit that it was impossible to have it both ways. Quote, Margaret attempted to reconcile her new vision of a society purified by the efforts of women with the social ideals that had fueled her energies as a radical. She did not intend birth control to replace, quote, any of the idealistic movements and philosophies of the workers. It is not a substitute. It precedes. It can and must be the foundation upon which any permanently successful improvement in condition is attained. Yet she could not have it both ways. By identifying birth control as a panacea, she certainly undermined the objectives of the revolutionary labor struggle, and by housing her abstract arguments in a practical political framework focused wholly on one issue, she implicitly challenged the value of even a more moderate agenda of progressive social reform. Contraception, more than anything else, defeated economic development because it defined people and not maldistribution as the source of the problem. Well, neither of them is the problem, actually. Yet in framing the issue that way, its supporters made contraception attractive to both sides in the class struggle in the United States. The left got sexual liberation, and the rich got to preserve economic privilege, and people like Margaret Sanger got both in a convergence that would eventually subordinate the left's desire for social justice to its desire for sexual license. The effect of this convergence on people like Sanger and her lover H.G. Wells is evident to even devotees of contraception like Chesler, who indicates that once they become famous as promoters of the New World Order by making the contraceptive the sine qua non, the absolutely essential thing of progress, nay, identical with progress itself, Sanger and Wells, quote, seem reluctant to condemn the maldistribution of wealth, goods, and services that gave rise to the widespread discontent in the economies of the West. Thus, it comes as no surprise that the Rockefellers became so amenable to the funding request of the lady who called for their assassination. Birth control, it turns out, created by the racial fears of the 20s, the ones which found expression in the Great Gatsby, the more the upper classes engaged in non-reproductive sex, the more they became concerned about those who didn't. Thus, out of their behavior was born the fear of differential fertility rates. Taken at its most basic form, the fear over differential fertility meant the fear that somewhere someone was having more children than the upper classes were. Eventually, the fact that all the best people were limiting the size of their families meant that those who were not limiting the size of their families were not good people. Hence, eugenics was the solution to the troubled Malthusian conscience of the wealthy classes during the early part of the century. Contraceptive use, once established, became a moral imperative for all humanity, at least according to the views of those who were using it. With the Depression and the efforts of people like Monsignor Ryan, the contraceptive/Malthusian ideology suffered a setback that was only confirmed by general repugnance at Nazi ideology, which took the eugenics movement to its logical conclusion. But as contraceptive use persisted, of course, birth rate went up under the Nazis, which he doesn't see fit to acknowledge. The Nazis were not against having families. They actually subsidized large families. If they got rid of a few retards and didn't let people who are genetically sick reproduce, that's what Jones is against, because those are the customers of his church. But as contraceptive use persisted and increased, so would the pressure to use it as the panacea for all social problems. The Birth Control League changed its name to Planned Parenthood in 1942, and after the war, people like Bernard Berelson, using money from John D. Rockefeller III's Population Council, would take a different tack and use the newly burgeoning communications media to persuade people to do to themselves what hitherto the state had to do to them with the threat of coercion. And judges could order people sterilized in the U.S. in the first part of the 20th century. Similarly, the discovery of the pill and the IUD in the early 60s was followed almost immediately by the fear that the world was overpopulated. Contraception once again was being proposed as the social panacea, and this time the Catholic Church, subverted from within by people like the Reverend Theodore Hesburgh, CSC, who used Rockefeller money to fund secret conferences on contraception at the University of Notre Dame from 1962 to 1965, so he was a cuck to Catholicism, he sold it out for Rockefeller money, was unable to stem the tide. The Malthusian ideology was back in business, with government funding now, and one of the ironies is that it was the Democrats, the party of John A. Ryan and the working man, who put it there. That shift to the Malthusian ideology as the cornerstone of both domestic and foreign policy was the essence of the Cultural Revolution of the 1960s. The Democrats, who once believed in fostering development by defending the interests of the working man, at some point converted to the view of their opponents and adopted the Rockefeller view that population was the problem. With the triumph of the Malthusian ideology in the 60s, the role of government changed as well from an entity which promoted the welfare of its citizens to one committed to increasing its control over them by limiting their numbers. Part 2, Chapter 7, Baltimore, 1916. In the 1930 edition of his famous book, which first appeared when Europe dissolved into war, John B. Watson tried to allay any fears his readers might have concerning social experimentation. First of all, he assured them, we must all admit that social experimentation is going on at a very rapid rate at present, at an alarmingly rapid rate for comfortable, conventional souls. As an example of social experimentation, we have war. When America entered the war in 1916, John B. Watson tried to enlist as a line officer. He was turned down because of his eyesight, but a year later he would get another chance. In July of 1917, the psychologist E.L. Thorndike, now in the War Department's Committee on Personnel, wrote to President Goodnow of Johns Hopkins asking him to release Watson for military service with half pay. Watson, who was 38 years old at the time, was commissioned as a major in August of 1917 and put to work administering aptitude tests to aspiring pilots. The tests he devised eventually proved worthless, and given his temperament and his drinking habits, it was inevitable that Watson would soon be quarreling with his superiors, which landed him a job training carrier pigeons, whose value was rendered dubious by the improvements in the wireless. He was then sent to England to interview British pilots, but when he arrived, they were too busy to talk to him. He was then sent to the front near Nancy in France, where he remained within hearing distance of the war for 3 months, with nothing much to do until he got disgusted and asked to be shipped home. On that voyage, he came as close to war as he ever would be, as he watched a torpedo go sailing past the stern of his ship. While away from home, Watson also met with British psychologists and had numerous affairs. The war may not have been particularly beneficial to Major Watson, but it was good for psychology. War and behaviorism were made for each other. Unlike Germanic introspection, behaviorism was pragmatic and American, and it promised results. Its greatest triumph during the war, if one can call it that, was intelligence tests, which were promptly used by the racist eugenics crowd after the war as an indication that the great majority of Americans, especially those of immigrant stock, were feeble-minded idiots. A wave of sterilization laws swept the country's legislatures as a result, the most famous of which got contested at the Supreme Court level in Buck v. Bell, the case which prompted Chief Justice Holmes to opine that, quote, 3 generations of imbeciles were enough. The man more responsible than anyone else for the promotion of intelligence tests in the military was Watson's friend and collaborator, Robert M. Yerkes, who was commissioned as a major in 1916, the same year he was elected head of the American Psychological Association, the same year he was appointed head of the National Research Council. War was the catalyst that brought big government and big business and big science together in the project of social engineering, a project that would be applied to the civilian sector as soon as the war was over. In March of 1919, in his report of the Psychological Committee of the National Research Council, Yerkes could announce with a certain amount of self-satisfaction and pride that, quote, 2 years ago, mental engineering was the dream of a few visionaries. Today it is a branch of technology which, although created by the war, is evidently to be perpetuated and fostered by education and industry. If that were the case, in fact, it was the result largely of Yerkes' efforts and his collaboration with John B. Watson. In the spring of 1916, Yerkes had received a letter from a jubilant Watson announcing that he had just been hired as a personal consultant by the Wilmington Life Insurance Company. Watson was involved in negotiations for a similar contract with the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad, and sure that a similar contract with them would be soon to follow. The merger of business and academe seemed promising for both parties, but especially for the university, which could now demonstrate its usefulness to the business community in a concrete way, while at the same time bolstering its prestige on campus with increased funding. Watson was already offering a course in the psychology of advertising at Johns Hopkins and hoped to expand future course offerings in the business economics major to include courses which would explain to future managers how they could apply the insights of psychology in controlling their employees. The establishment of the NRC created the precedent that government should be involved in funding scientific research, and it also established the premise that scientists like Yerkes and Watson, and not politicians, would say how that money was going to be spent. The war also did much to win over the public mind, especially the business sector, to appreciating the value of psychology. Having given the impression that psychology was instrumental in the managing of 1 million men in uniform at a time of rapid change, Yerkes and Watson went on to claim that behavioral psychology would now help businessmen choose the right employees, control crime, and keep men, quote, honest and sane, and their ethical and social life upon a high and well-regulated plane. Rather than have employers change the working environment to suit clamorous and increasingly unionized employees, Behaviorism offered the promise of changing employees to suit their jobs. It was an offer that the plutocrats found hard to resist. The Goodyear Tire and Rubber Company showed an interest in the practical side of mental engineering, and the Psychology Committee of the NRC received a large grant from the Rockefeller Foundation for the development of intelligence tests. The NRC under Yerkes, and in collaboration with Watson, played a crucial role in insinuating behaviorism's vision of social control throughout the emerging but already interlocking complex of big government, big business, and big science. So the rise of big psychology. A confidential memorandum outlining the purpose of NRC emphasized the need to stimulate the growth of science and its application to industry. According to its founders, the NRC was organized particularly with a view to the coordination of research agencies for the sake of enabling the United States, in spite of its democratic, individualistic organization, to bend its energies effectively toward a common purpose. Mental engineering would allow employers to find trainable workers among the unskilled, allowing the employers to bypass the trade unions and pay lower wages. Behaviorism was always seen as an instrument of control by its founder, and now it was being implemented as such by those who controlled the means of production. While the first generation of psychologists, people like G. Stanley Hall and William James, were still retained the morals of the Victorian era, Watson felt that morals were simply the response to a stimulus, and that the stimulus was the prevailing social order. Behaviorism, according to Buckley, would make techniques of social adjustment available to those who wish to determine that order. Might made right, that much was clear. Behaviorism was simply a way to put that Nietzschean order into practice. As a result, behaviorism began to be seen as an instrument of political control as well. Just as Dewey, Lippmann, Crowley, and the crowd at New Republic wanted a war because they were interested in social engineering, they were just as interested in promoting behaviorism as a way of continuing that engineering in peacetime. Just what that meant became clear from their writings. In Public Opinion, Walter Lippmann described a melting pot pageant which had probably taken place on July 4, 1918, when George Creel's campaign to undermine the identity of ethnic groups in America reached its high point. Quote, "It was called the melting pot, and it was given on the 4th of July in an automobile town where many foreign-born workers are employed. In the center of the baseball park at second base stood a huge wooden and canvas pot. There were flights of steps up to the rim on two sides. After the audience had settled itself and the band had played, a procession came through an opening at one side of the field. It was made up of men of all the foreign nationalities employed in the factories. They wore their native costumes, they were singing their national songs, they danced their folk dances and carried the banners of all Europe. The master of ceremonies was the principal of the grade school, dressed as Uncle Sam. He led them to the pot. He directed them up the sides, the steps to the rim, inside. He called them out again on the other side. They came out dressed in derby hats, coats, pants, vest, stiff collar, and polka dot tie, undoubtedly, said my friend, each with an ever-sharp pencil in his pocket, and singing the Star-Spangled Banner." This anecdote gives an accurate view of the liberal project of social control, which began during the war and was carried over into civilian life during the 20s, when the population at large was asked to abandon its allegiance to the ethnic neighborhood and the small town and conform its habits to national markets, brand names, and science, quote-unquote, is the ultimate arbiter of behavior. Lippmann, Crowley, Dewey, and the New Republic saw behaviorism continuing what the war had started, a consolidation of power in a strong central state. As the United States edged closer to the brink of World War I, an influential group of American progressives seized upon the conflict as a means of transforming American society. Herbert Crowley, who championed a strong central state to promote economic and political freedom, and his co-editor at the New Republic, Walter Lippmann, saw the war as a, quote, "rare opportunity to advance democracy abroad and begin social reconstruction at home." By social reconstruction, Crowley and Lippmann meant the substitution of rational planning for the old authorities that had been discredited or destroyed by the advent of modern industrial life. Lippmann and Crowley were essentially articulating the position put forth by John Dewey, quote, who urged that the war be used as an efficient means of achieving intelligent control over the economic and political process. The same group of people saw the war as their best ally in undermining Victorian mores and reestablishing in its place a modern way of life, since it was the first time in history that an entire society was mobilized for total war. In the theories of Lippmann and Harold Lasswell, we have the beginning of modern psychological warfare. The beginnings of modern psychological warfare, Lippmann and Harold Lasswell. Lasswell's theory of communication, who says what to whom and with what effect, could also be used to suppress rival visions of communication, and this was precisely how it was used in the rise of the age of modern advertising, which began around the time of the war, World War I again. Mass marketing, as Eddie Bernays realized, was an all-or-nothing proposition. It meant replacing one set of values, ethnic, traditional, religious, with another, impulsive, suggestible, scientific, quote-unquote. It meant, in other words, the erosion of traditional societies by mass media and the substitution of local products by national brand names. Mass media advertising worked only with brand names in mass markets served by an infrastructure like the railroad system. Watson was at one with Lippmann and Lasswell in the vision they shared of the technocratic state, which, according to Lippmann, science would provide the bond that would make democracy cohesive and effective. Behaviorism was crucial to that vision because behaviorism gave man the ability now to shape the psychic, and therefore social world, just as physics had given him the ability to shape the material world. Lippmann saw the development of an infinitely greater control of human invention in sciences that were learning to control the inventor. Dewey likewise saw in behaviorism the ability to control the most crucial environment, the human mind. Once man could do that, and Watson had shown that it could be done, man could take control of the future. All that man had to do was to press forward until we have a control of human nature comparable to our control of physical nature. Missing from these utopian accounts of the future was the fact that behaviorism had been used during the war, as Lippmann's account of the melting pot pageant made clear, as a form of psychological warfare against recalcitrant ethnic groups. In this respect, the liberal state which the Dewey et al. Envisioned was also a state in a constant state of covert ethnic warfare. The triumph of man over nature meant the triumph of some men over other men, using science as their weapon. Herbert Croly completed the liberal vision of the future by revising American history and coming up with a politics more suitable to a scientific age. Jefferson, Croly felt, was too committed to the maintenance of local communities. Instead of the division of powers proposed by the Founding Fathers, Croly proposed a vastly strengthened presidency which, responding directly to public opinion, would give embodiment to the general will of the national community. In Croly, we see the link between the French Revolution and the Clinton administration. His repudiation of the system proposed by the Founding Fathers saw the creation of a direct democracy, quote-unquote, as its goal, a goal which would find fulfillment in a president who could bypass the legal system and rule directly by manipulating the passions of the masses and then present himself as the embodiment of their will. Like Watson and Lippmann, Croly had faith in science. He, however, unlike them, got it from his parents, who venerated Auguste Comte. Together they embarked on a project to destroy the American Republic and erect in its place an empire based on the most sophisticated manipulation the world had ever known. And that will end that chapter in our segment for today. So, the rise of national brands, the rise of national advertising, and the infrastructure, communications, and transportation to make it possible. And then the rise of science or science of psychology, the pseudoscience of psychoanalysis, is ways to manipulate people and milk money out of them and obtain a political control over them. True illuminism. Control them for your own financial and political benefit by studying their passions and knowing them. Anyway, thanks for being with me today, and I'll be back with you with more from Libido Dominandi real soon.